snake fights to break free. The bird bites the snake again and again, sending bloody splatters against the floor of the enclosure. Until at last, the snake seemingly succumbs to its wounds and lies still. The bird, also bloodied, begins to tremble and then shake, the poison taking hold. On the floor, their shadows quiver, forming mysterious shapes, clawed creatures approaching our feet. I step back, even though I am almost certain they are just shadows. Almost. The scent of frost grows stronger, and our breath can be seen in the air, an impossibility in summer. Chungju strides forward, a small dish in hand. He places it in front of the bird, and I recognize what's on it as feverberry, the same berry I offered to Pengge in the library earlier, the one that induces mild vomiting. The bird pecks at it and eats the clump of berries rapidly, then throws up a mess of black liquid. The poison expelled, death averted. Wenyi lets out a sigh, and the shadows in the pavilion ease, retreating back into their normal shapes. He wipes his brow and takes a sip of water, his complexion paler than normal. The judges clap politely. The Marquis frowns, covering his face with a handkerchief, his distaste clear. Minister Song appears slightly pale, taking a quick sip of his water as well. "That was certainly a sight to behold," Elder Guo strides forth with a raised brow. "Use the poison to create a threat, forcing the bird to be on the defensive, and in doing so, ingest a small amount of Jing Tan in the snake's blood, one that can easily be expelled by purging." "Can the snake be revived?" the princess asks, appearing troubled. "No, Highness." Wenyi bows his head. "It is animation, approximating movement, nothing more. A puppet dancing from a string. It is a clever solution, but one unappreciated by the judges." "Pity," the chancellor comments. "It would have been preferable if the snake could have lived." Their piya is carried out of the enclosure, making pitiful noises. But my attention remains on the snake, remembering the one that attacked me on the rock. It does not move, its one visible pale eye staring into nothing. The servant slides it back into the pot, where it lands in the water with a heavy squelch. Blood drips down the side of the table. "It's dead," I repeat to myself. "And the shadows are only shadows. As if repeating it often enough will make it true." Chapter 35. We stand before Elder Guo, waiting to be dismissed. The round concluded. "Only six remain." She clasps her hands together. "Six competitors, but room for only three in the final round." "Three?" Guoming yelps, his confidence slipping in an instant. The four young men regard each other uneasily, assessing who is the biggest threat, notably ignoring Lian and me. "Legend says that when the world was first created, there were six gods: the bird of the south, the tiger of the north, the carp of the east, and the tortoise of the west. The twin gods ruled over them all: the jade dragon of the river, and the gold serpent of the cloud sea. But the gold serpent became jealous of how our ancestors worshipped the jade dragon for bringing water to their fertile lands, and offered up great treasures that filled his underwater palace." Even if it is a story I've heard many times before, her words ring hypnotic in the air, drawing us in. "He deceived his brother by luring him into his mountain domain and trapped him under the granite peaks of Kunming. To demonstrate his displeasure at the pitiful humans, the gold serpent flooded the purple valley with storms, and many perished. The four remaining gods attempted to overthrow the gold serpent, but he proved too powerful for even the other gods. They banded together and broke the jade dragon from his prison, and the skies thundered from the fierce battle. Brother against brother, God against God. The ancient story spoken into the night seems to gain power on its own, and the wind stills. Even the frogs have stopped croaking. There's only silence as we listen to the conclusion of the creation tale. When the gold serpent finally fell from the sky, his blood dotted the lakes and ponds of Daxi like rain. Where his blood touched water, water lilies bloomed. But the jade dragon also perished, and the four gods lifted him up into the heavens. They were never seen to walk among humans again. Elder Guo's voice softens. When the water lily flowers, we remember how the gods once roamed the earth. In the pond behind me, there are three water lilies with treasure hidden inside their blooms. The first three of you to find one and bring it back to us will continue forward in the competition. May the gods guide you in your search. She bows, and the challenge is on. A loud splash sounds as Guoming has already raced down the stone steps and is in the water, shoving aside floating leaves. Chengzhi is not far behind him, taking just as little care with the plants. Xiao carefully steps into the water, reaching down to tentatively touch a closed bud. Wen Yi stands at the edge of the pond, considering the stretch of water lilies before him with a pensive look. The fragile alliances have already broken, each of them now fending for themselves. Treasure, Lian joins me at the water's edge. What do you think it means? I'm not sure. I frown, kneeling by the trampled path through the lilies that Guoming and Chengzhi made with their bodies. Touching my finger to a leaf, I can sense the plants screaming, their roots having been disturbed. Even without tea as a bridge, the plants have always spoken to me. I can hear their pleasure in sunny days or when they murmur excitedly, "Rain is coming," like small children. But the magic makes it easier to sense them, hear them whispering to each other. The people came. The people came into the water, but they were careful. Not like these brutes. They will not find what they are looking for. What they remember, fingers carefully prying open a bloom, holding it apart. Something being placed inside, small in size. Round with a pungent scent. I ask them if they will show me where these secrets are. I open my eyes and Lian is watching me, a small smile on her lips. I know where they are, I say to her, voice low so the others do not hear. I'll get you one. Come, we can go to the final round together. Lian's smile wavers when I expect her to exclaim with her typical enthusiasm and delight. And I do not understand why. Remember when we first met? I gesture at the men splashing, stumbling about in the dark. We wanted to show them there are Shenlongtu outside Jia, to prove them wrong. Here is our chance. It could be her attempt at kindness, to make sure she will not be my competitor in the final round, but I want to be there with her together, a worthy friend and opponent. I'm sorry, Ning. She shakes her head. I can't go ahead in this competition. I wanted to tell you tonight, after the end of this round. My family is returning to Kala. Even though I know the nature of the competition means we will have to part eventually, I had hoped she would still remain in the palace because of her father's position. That I would still have a friend and wouldn't have to be alone. Seeing the look on my face, she leans closer and whispers, The princess has sent me away for another purpose. Do not worry about me. She pokes me in the shoulder hard. Go! I return to the water lilies, still reluctant. It doesn't seem fair. But the plants whisper eagerly, directing me to where the prize is hidden. There. There. Following their encouragements, I find one not far away. A flower that whispers about the secret tucked inside it. The wet seeps into my shoes and the bottom of my skirt as I bend down and cup my hand around the bloom, asking for permission to reach within. The poets call them sleeping beauties because they open with the midday heat and then close at night when the air cools. But under my fingers, the petals slowly unfurl, revealing a small black ball at the center. I pick it up, and it pulses with a peculiar warmth against my skin. I give the water lilies my silent thanks, and the surrounding blooms wave in acknowledgement. Stepping out of the pond, I am the first to return to the pavilion and offer the ball for Elder Guo's inspection. She sniffs it and nods, proclaiming that it is good. Someone else gives a shout as another competitor discovers the next hidden treasure. I wince at the number of water lilies that were disturbed for them to find their prize, and hope the gardeners will be able to tend to them. We all return to the pavilion after a time. I stand with Wen Yi and Shao as the ones who emerge victorious. Guoming's dark expression does not hide his displeasure at losing so close to the end, and Chengzhi looks resigned, arms crossed. Lian is the only one who still looks pleased, as if a weight has been lifted off her shoulders. "For the three of you who will not be moving forward, I commend you all for reaching this point of the competition," Minister Song says, resuming his role as the Minister of Rights. "You will return to your households with recognition, commendations sent to your Shenongshi, and treasures for your families. You will be reunited with them tomorrow. Rest well tonight." The three of them bow and leave the pavilion. Lian gives me a wink of encouragement and a wave, then she's gone. Even though I should be glad I am moving on to the next round, I still feel a sense of loss. "Now," Minister Song returns to us, regarding us intensely. "The final round of the competition. The future court Shenongshi stands before me." He meets our eyes in turn as if he is able to see our weaknesses, our doubts and hesitations. "The astronomers have spoken," he announces. "A ruler will ascend, and the court Shenongshi will provide wisdom and guidance, like those who have advised before you. Your final trial will be presented before the court. They will witness the marvels of Shennong and deem one of you worthy. Keep the medicine ball you found inside the water lilies. You will need it for the next round." We all look down at the inconspicuous shape in our hands, wondering what clue it might provide us about what awaits us in the final round. "Your belongings will be moved into the residence of Harmonious Spring tonight. And tomorrow, we shall see which one of your stars will shine the brightest over Jia." Chapter 36. The weak morning light illuminates my unfamiliar, luxurious surroundings. Without Lian's morning greeting or even Pengge's chirpy serenade, the room feels cold. I've made it to the final round. My goal is within reach, yet I remain restless. I try to distract myself by reading through wondrous tales, but it does not have the same pull as those stories usually do. Walking through our garden courtyard, I see Shao and Wen Yi playing a game of strategy through the open doors of Shao's quarters. The two mirror each other, focus intent on the board before them, elbows on their knees, directing their horses and chariots across the board. There is no invitation extended to me, and I do not intrude. I am well aware of where I fit in these perfumed corridors. I attempt to leave the residence to at least stroll in the gardens, but there are soldiers positioned at the door by decree of the Chancellor for our own protection. But I've seen how easy it is to enter and leave the palace, the number of tunnels that run through the walls. How safe can any of us ever be in the palace? "Wait," one of the soldiers calls out to me. "A letter came for you." He bows and passes me a bamboo scroll secured with twine. I sit on the redwood stool in my receiving room and examine the scroll, expecting it to be a letter of farewell from Lian. Except when I open it, I realize it does not unfurl. Instead, it is a tube meant for transport, something sealed within, a rolled-up sheet of paper and a soft scrap of embroidered fabric. A peony, the Empress of Flowers, blooms from the center of the fabric, a vibrant red. Each petal is lined with gold thread, stitched with painstaking detail. But it is growing in a bed of rippling grasses of a peculiar color, deep red to dark purple. In the background are spotted branches like trees in various shades of pink. The moon glows in the sky like a watchful eye. In the corner are characters in red thread, depicting a phrase from one of my mother's favorite poems, one she made us recite frequently, learn by heart. It is the poem that tells me this is Shu's handiwork.
海底有明月，圆于天上轮.
A bright moon mirrored in the sea, as round as the wheel in the sky. With shaking hands, I unfurl the sheet of paper, dreading the message in black ink, written by my father's hand.
Nian, I hope this letter reaches you in time. I know you have left us in search of a different life, and I do not begrudge you of that. I admit I thought you would fail, entertain this foolishness for a few days and return to the safety of home. It isn't until these weeks have gone by that I recognize I have chosen my pride rather than my daughter's. I should not have devoted all my time to the villagers, believing you capable of looking after yourself. I did not imagine you would take on such a burden on behalf of your sister. That should have been my role. But now I have uncovered more ways in which I have failed you both. Shu has been experimenting with tea bricks, testing an antidote on herself. I should have seen the hubris of her youth and tried to stop her. She has tried to prevent me from reaching out to you, but now she is too weak to protest. She only asks that I include her embroidery to let you know she is thinking of you. She believes you will return successful. I do not think she has much time left. Please, I ask you, come back and say goodbye to your sister, father.
A teardrop splatters on the page, smearing the ink. I retreat to my bedchamber before anyone can see me weeping. My fingers grope for the prayer bead necklace hidden in my sleeve, but the comfort I seek eludes me. My sister has never forsaken me, even when she was beloved by all and could have easily left me behind. She was the one who remembered my dreams, pushed me and said, go. I thought I wanted to bring home all the riches a palanquin could carry, show them that the pregnant girl they scorned has a daughter who is advisor to a princess, prove to my mother's family that we are worthy of their recognition. But in the end, it is always the thought of Shu, the certainty she is waiting for me at the end that propels me. I read my father's words again and again. As I am here in the palace working toward an antidote, Shu has been doing the same even from her sickbed. Why would she do something so reckless? I want to return to Su and demand an answer, but another part of me laughs, knowing only she would have the sheer stubbornness to come up with such a gamble. She has been risking her life to find a cure, even as she entrusted me to fight for her in the trials. And now, what do I have to show for my escape to the capital? A meager clue from the chancellor. A kiss from a boy I shouldn't have kissed on a beach beside a hidden lake. I know I should keep my promise to myself, for him to remain a beautiful memory, a foolish tryst. But I am too far tangled with him. I have to pull that loose thread, even knowing everything will unravel. Mingwen arrives at my residence to deliver the midday meal, disrupting me from my dark thoughts. Cold noodles, continuing the summer tradition, tossed with peanut oil and sesame sauce, releasing a mouth-watering scent. Other small dishes accompany the noodles, thin-sliced stewed pig's ear and shredded cucumber mixed with chunks of garlic. But when she sets the dishes on the table, her presence reminds me that servants can travel freely around the palace. I will have my answer. It may be the only way I can find the cure before my time, Shu's time, runs out.
I will rip it out of him if I have to. I stand up and close the door, gesturing at Mingwen. I need to borrow your uniform for an hour, I tell her as she is setting the utensils down on the table. She turns to me, a frown already forming, ready to deny my request. But then I'm clutching at her arm, begging her. Just an hour, I plead, piecing together a plan with what little I have. All you have to do is stay in my residence. Tell them you are resting and require privacy for quiet reflection if they come to find you. Her frown deepens. Where are you going? You will be disobeying a direct order from the Chancellor. They will never allow you to continue if you are caught. I race to my bedroom and fumble among my belongings to find my mother's hairpin. Please. I hold it out to Mingwen, the jewels sparkling in the light. Many of the beautiful things my mother had had from the capital she sold for coin, but she had kept this one. Cherry blossoms dotted with pearls and gold branches, a reminder of her life in the palace, a representation of all the happy memories she fed me, and much more she never shared. Mingwen takes the pin and examines it, appearing conflicted. You are willing to part with this? She asks. Lend me your clothes and keep my secret, and it is yours, I tell her. She looks down at the pin again before closing her hand over it and nodding. 1 hour. Adjusting the basket on my arm, I nod at the guards at the door. The hair Mingwen piled up on my head and secured with her own pin feels heavy, lopsided. I keep my breath held as I walk away from the residence, expecting one of them to call out my name, expose my ruse, but no one stops me. I recognize the Marquis' residence, with its red pillars and brown walls in the distance. Walking down the other path, I keep my gaze to my feet when passing the other servants, hoping to appear inconspicuous. I stop at the gate to the residence of Winter's Dreaming, which I confirmed with Mingwen is where the son of the banished prince resides. High white walls hold up a black roof. Stone wolves guard the door. Is it an honor, or is it a prison? The guards at the door let me pass, seeing me as a faceless kitchen servant. I note the red helmets and armor, indicating they're members of the elite palace guard. Aware of Kong's skills, they have assigned highly trained men to guard him. This courtyard is small, much smaller than the other residences, but still elegantly maintained. White and black stones form curved patterns, encircling small bonsai trees on raised platforms. The door up ahead is open, revealing a small receiving room with a pair of carved wood chairs and a table between them. A scroll hangs on the back wall, a brush painting depicting the rooftops of a city. Hesitant, I make my way up the steps and over the threshold. To my right and left, there are arched doorways, marked by carved filigree. A wooden screen of birds hides the room to the right from view. The left doorway opens to a larger room, from which drifts the calming scent of Benduin. Benduin is meant to ease stress and soothe a restless mind. I wonder what thoughts Kong is trying to chase away. I take another step closer. The room before me appears to be a study, but the shelves are mostly empty. There are only a few scrolls, some unrolled, and others haphazardly stacked on top of one another. A discarded robe hangs on the back of a vase. Kong stands at a round table, leaning on the surface with his arms outstretched, hair tied neatly, and collar smoothed. He is dressed in light blue befitting the younger members of the court, not the mourning white meant for the emperor's family or the black of bereavement donned by the ministers. Lian would question whether the princess thought it an insult, a mark of his preferred distance from the royal family. But all I can think about is how the blue suits him. You can set the tray over by the door, he says, not looking up from what he is studying intently. I try to find my voice, my rehearsed speech. I want to hurl my verbal barbs at him. I want to hurt him as much as he's hurt me, but I can't seem to form the words. He turns to look at me, and it takes a moment, but he straightens when he recognizes me. A stack of scrolls falls to the floor with a clatter, knocked over by the startled sweep of his arm. "Ning," he breathes, and my heart falls to my feet to join the scrolls. Chapter 37. We kneel at the same time. I place my basket to the side in order to help him. He gathers the scrolls into his arms while I pick up two that had rolled to my feet, all the while taking him in. Gone is the reckless son of a wealthy merchant, hair down to his shoulders, leading me through the streets of Jia. He looks like a scholar waiting for the exams instead, reputable. He sets the scrolls onto the table while I place the ones I have on a shelf. "I didn't know it was you," he starts hesitantly. "Or else I would have..." I interrupt him by turning and fumbling for what I hid in the basket instead, thrusting the wooden box in his direction when I face him again. Trying to prevent my emotions from showing up on my face. Trying to prevent him from saying something we will both regret. The golden key hums, recognizing him, trying to pull us closer. Confusion spreads across his face as he slides the lid off. The beautiful dagger is there, cleaned of Ruyi's blood. I liked the feel of it in my hands when my senses were heightened by magic, but I don't want any memory of him to remain with me when I leave this place. "It was a gift," he says, not understanding. I envision sealing myself in a fortress, surrounded by ferocious beasts, in order to say what I must. To sever the ties between us so irreparably that there is nothing left to mend. The truth is what I wield, as sharp as any dagger. "I spoke with Jin," I say to him. "She told me your father was behind the poison tea bricks, that the main ingredient was yellow quinbu, a seaweed grown only in the Emerald Isles." Surprise flickers across his face, then his mouth draws into a thin line. "If I swear to you right now, on the old gods, that I didn't know about this, would you believe me?" I remind myself that he is an adept performer, able to wear his expression as smoothly as any mask. "Does it matter?" I ask, and he flinches like I've struck him. "From the first moment I met you, you have lied to me. Every time you've offered a glimpse of yourself, with a golden key, the silver needle, but still continue to twist the words so you can hide your true intentions. And those are?" His words prickle, sharp as nettles. "To get close to the princess," I say to him. "To earn her trust, promise her no harm, draw on her sympathies using your friendship as children. Once you are safely established, then you will find a way to assist your father onto the throne." As I continue to speak, his outrage changes to sadness, then finally eases into resignation. "Everyone knows about my father's ambitions, his desire for vengeance, and they would not be wrong if they see him as a threat," he says, voice flat. "You're going to tell me you are not like your father? Because you are his adopted son?" I retort. But when the words leave my mouth, they spin in the air like leaves in the wind, taking on new intentions. Mocking. Meant to hurt. "There are many things I thought you could be," he tells me, clenching his jaw. "But I didn't think you would be so purposely cruel." He turns away so I cannot see his face. I realize then how much I hurt him with a single comment, knowing what I know about his past. About how he felt like an outsider twice over, first in the general's household, then when they were banished to the Emerald Isles. Even though I want desperately for him to look at me again like he used to when he held me close, I need to make sure this knife goes in as deep as possible, to protect myself and everything I could lose if I fail. "You don't know anything about me either," I say quietly. "I lied when I begged you to take me out of the palace. I lied about my loneliness. I had to get close to you at the bidding of the princess, and that was the only way I could think of." His shoulders hunch and I can see color flooding into his face. I know he is thinking of all our shared words and intimacies, wondering what was real and what was a lie. Now I feel a nasty twinge of vindication. Let him be as uncertain as me. He turns back to me again, voice cracking. And did you find what you were looking for? Not enough. I would have done things differently. He blinks, looking at me hesitantly, waiting to hear something kinder, and I shatter that hope. I should have pretended to care about your cause, encouraged you to get the antidote from your father. So everything out of your mouth was a lie? He says, shaking. Just two liars, telling each other words we thought the other wanted to hear? I say nothing, but he suddenly laughs. He bends forward, hands on his knees, laughing until he sounds like he will be sick. Are you quite finished? I ask him when he pauses to wheeze a little, drawing in a hurried breath. He makes a sound between a chuckle and a choke, rubbing his arms as if they pain him. I meant everything I said, every word. If I had the antidote for your sister, I would have given it to you. You can stop trying to convince me of your lies, I say, even though I hate that some part of me still trembles, wanting to believe him. Kong reaches out and touches my cheek. Even though I should slap him away, scream and call him a traitor, a part of me still longs to lean into that touch, into the insistent tug between us that I do not know if I can blame on the golden key any longer. We are two people who are trying to find a place to belong, to live a life without pretending, without the complicated histories of our families. But the distance between us is too far, as vast as the divide between brothers who fought for a throne, or gods who tore apart a continent. My people have a blessing, he whispers, eyes as deep as sacred pools and mountain lakes. May the sea be willing. May it bring you what you are looking for. I will never begrudge you that. His hand falls back to his side, and it takes all my effort, all my strength, not to grab it, not to pull him close and kiss him senseless until all the words fall away, until none of it matters anymore. But I don't. Mingwen opens her mouth when I step through the door, but I shake my head and she does not ask any questions. I read Father's letter again. This time, I'm able to decipher the worry behind the lines of careful restraint, the effort it must have taken for him to admit he was wrong. I do not think she has much time left. I resist the urge to rip the letter to pieces, and instead I throw the Book of Wondrous Tales against the wall, where it hits with a satisfying crack. Foolish stories for foolish children, Father once called them. He was right. Chapter 38. Everything has led to this point. All my careful deceptions, all the things I never thought I was capable of. I am dressed and powdered, hair brushed and pinned to appear presentable. I miss Lian's bad jokes about banquets and wish again she was still here with me. Third in line in the procession, I trail behind Shao and Winyi. I pat my sash again for the 10th time to make sure the medicine ball is still there. We entered the courtyard of Promising Future, where we once performed in front of the citizens of Jia. It is empty now, except for a scattering of soldiers along the walls. We ascend the grand stairwell, for the first time permitted to walk the path many honored guests have walked before us, an acknowledgement that one of us will soon become the next Shenongshi to serve the court. I grit my teeth. The choices I made have gotten me here, and I will see it through. We enter the Hall of Eternal Light. The windows are opened again, and the view of Jia's vastness is awe-inspiring, meant for visiting dignitaries and foreign powers to witness the glories of the Emperor of Daxi. The room is filled with members of the court of officials, the nobility and the scholars. Two sides of the court, influence and knowledge. All of them have donned the black mourning sash. My eyes sweep over the officials, most involved in casual conversation before the formal gathering is to proceed. Who among them betrayed the emperor? Which of them has pledged fealty to the banished prince? And who distributed the poison through Daxi? The gong announces the start of the proceedings. The officials settle with a rustle of robes, while the ministers stand on the dais to receive the princess. The competitors are also given cushions near the back of the hall, and we kneel. The empty throne presides over us all. The herald announces her arrival, and we bow. Princess Jin strides across the room, a vision in her robes. Peonies cascade from her shoulders, dark purple blooms outlined with gold, striking against the white background. She wears a small formal headdress, jeweled birds glinting in the light when she turns her head. But instead of Ruyi, there is another familiar figure following her, dressed in deep purple robes, matching the color of the peonies, a black sash around his waist. Kang, son of the banished prince, clad in a color permitted only to royalty. The officials buzz, uncertain, while I wish I could fade into the wooden screen behind me and become one with the wall, remembering the harsh words we utter to one another in his residence. But he does not glance in my direction. My contrary heart should be thankful for this, yet a part of me still aches at this disregard. Jin sits at the seat to the right of the empty throne, as befitting the regent and soon-to-be ruler of Daxi, while Kang stands behind her. The herald steps forward again, and with a nod from the princess, he unfurls his scroll. Rise to hear the royal proclamation, people of Daxi! The court murmurs, the officials getting to their feet. Their expressions contain only bewilderment, as if this is not a common occurrence. But I do not have Lian beside me to interpret. By decree of Princess Yingzhen, regent of the gloriously ascended emperor, recognized from this point forth as the Emperor of Benevolence, acting on behalf of the consulted ancestors with respect to the period of mourning and her duty to foster peace across the whole of the kingdom, to remember and recognize how the Dowager Empress was once known as the Princess of Peace. In honor of Empress Wu Yang's betrothal to the ascended emperor, uniting two kingdoms and bringing an end to war. The herald pauses and clears his throat. The princess stares above all the heads of the officials, expression distant, eyes unseeing. The Princess of Daxi will be betrothed to Xu Kang, formally recognized as the adopted son of the Prince of Dai. The room erupts like a hornet's nest. But all I hear are three words repeated endlessly in my mind. Princess. Betrothed. Kang. Kang, who jumped from the rooftop into my courtyard to wish me luck in the second round of the competition, who gave me a beautiful gift from his homeland, showed me the secret parts of his childhood, told me of his dreams for his people, who I was sent to spy on, who I hurt and betrayed. My face burns as we drop, foreheads to the floor, receiving the proclamation. I close my eyes, recognizing how the chancellor was right. I am naive, thinking myself capable, but I am only a pawn sliding alongside the cannon on the board. The two of them played me against each other, and I had wanted so desperately to believe them both. The officials begin to shout, trying to speak over one another. Their words all run together in an incomprehensible rush. Quiet! The princess silences them with a single word. I open my eyes to see her with her hand raised. The two figures on the dais blur into smudges, as distant as the stars. Your Highness! A voice thunders across the room. I pinch myself, letting the pain return me to focus. The man who strides into view is clad in ceremonial armor, gleaming red. The Ministry of War has felt the effects of the coup, years later, even after the initial rebellion was quelled. Is it wise to resume those ties? A river of assent flows throughout the room, heads bobbing in agreement. The loss of the Prince of Dai has always been a blight on our history. Minister Song steps forward, a book open in his hand. Consulting the Book of Rites, I believe Xu Kang is an appropriate bridge between the two. He was the adopted son of the prince, but his birth father had obtained the rank of commander in the army, fought in the War of Two Rivers. His name was inscribed into the family texts by the Dowager Empress herself. He would be granted the rank of the Prince of Dai, mending our history. Other officials now speak in support, dividing the room. Another steps forward, introducing himself as the official for the management of Luzhou. We have kept a close eye on him all these years. He has never been involved with the rumored uprising. He grew up working on the salt farms and trained in another battalion, even though he could have easily joined the general's former troops. It is well known that he began his first post as a scout and worked his way up to captain. Minister Song flips to a new page in his book. Before the emperor ascended, he expressed his desire for his daughter to find a suitable match. At this point of transition, when the throne remains empty, we should all aim to spread a hopeful message, to quell the voices of the dissenters. This union may well turn the tide. The mood in the hall seems to shift as Chancellor Zhou rises, his sharp gaze sweeping the room. The princess herself has acquiesced, speaking for his character, having known him from childhood. Did we also forget he saved her from the assassins on the first night of the competition? The grumblings of the officials settles to a quiet rumble. At this point, the princess rises from her seat, her voice like a bell, clear and authoritative. I welcome the council of the court, as you have guided my father and my father's father. I rely on your help to maintain order in these dark times. The astronomers have been consulted, and they have determined that 3 is the auspicious number for my reign. My ascension, my betrothal, and the appointment of a new Shen Nongshi. With a sweep of her robe, she sits, concluding the matter. Let the final test begin. Chapter 39. We have not had an audience of this size since the first round, and the feeling of eyes on me is like the unwelcome sensation of ants crawling over my skin. I keep my head down as I walk past the waiting officials to join the judges at the front of the room. Chancellor Zhou is the one who steps forward in welcome. The judges have been blessed to witness the various abilities demonstrated by these 3 Shen Nongtu during the course of the competition. They have conjured up memories and dazzled our senses. They have countered poisons and coaxed truths from lies. We have given tribute to the virtues which provide guidance to our earthly existence. Harmony, he calls out, demonstrating yet again how he is able to control a crowd, commanding the attention of the court. In pairing food with tea, recognizing the regional variations that contribute to the composition of our great empire. Honesty and humility, he continues. A Shen Nongshi has a duty to provide the truth, even when the truth can harm. For only in receiving and accepting truth can a ruler confidently lead. Wisdom and compassion. A reminder that Shen Nong is a teacher and physician, a farmer and philosopher. A Shen Nongshi knows, as well as any physician, the balance between the internal and the external. We are humbled by death, but we will not bow to it. Finally, tonight we honor the virtue of dedication, the sacred connection of the Shen Nongshi to their patrons. He claps his hands 3 times. Servants begin to stream in, carrying cabinets and tables between them. The officials part for them as a circular stage is created in the center of the room. 3 chests, 3 tables. We three competitors are sent to stand beside them, regarding each other from around the circle. My hands clutch the edge of my table, etching the curve into my palm. Minister Song approaches us with a bamboo holder, red fortune sticks protruding from the top, like ones that can be requested from a temple for a blessing from the gods.
You shall draw lots.
Xiao shakes out the first stick and places it on his table. Wen Yi does the same, appearing somber. Finally, it comes to me. I close my eyes, tip the holder, and slide the stick out. Xiao's lot reveals the emerald tortoise, and Wen Yi the black tiger. Mine, unfurled with trembling hands, is the white crane. I pray this is a good omen, hoping the goddess has continued to guide me. The herald calls out for the champions to enter. Two men and one woman enter the hall, each dressed in their respective colors. The representative of the tortoise is a solidly built man, with dark brows and a mass of unruly black curls. He's dressed in a loose, sack-like shirt and shorts that reach the knee. His legs are massive tree trunks, rippling with muscle, ending in bare feet. He salutes the princess with both hands, a massive redwood staff in his fists. The black tiger champion is a muscular woman, arms bare except for red wraps wound around her wrists. Her flowing pants narrow around the ankles, and gold rings sparkle from her fingers. A single gold hoop is fastened to one ear. Strapped to her back are a pair of crossed swords. The final representative, the champion of the white crane, is a slender man dressed in a white robe. His hair is tied up in a sleek topknot and fastened with a single silver hairpin. If it weren't for the sword at his side, sheathed in a blue scabbard, I would have thought he was a scholar. He salutes the princess with clasped hands to his forehead, bowing from the waist. With their perfect posture, the grace of their movements, there is no doubt these are skilled martial artists.
Throughout Daxi's history, cities would rise or fall following the ancient tradition of the duel. The prowess of two champions willing to sacrifice their lives for the honor of claiming a city or defending it, the chancellor intones. Then he turns to regard the room.
Who will stand for Jia?
I will.
Heads turn to Kong as he descends the dais and walks into the circle. I can see the soldier's son in the set of his shoulders. My hand flies to my mouth, muffling a gasp. At once I feel a rush of fear that I've given myself away, but all attention is on Kong as he bows to the chancellor.
The betrothed of the princess, Chancellor Zhou smiles. You will put yourself in harm's way and stand for Jia and Daxi? You will prove you are worthy of the hand of the princess?
I am eager to demonstrate my loyalty to the throne of Daxi, Kong says, confident and unafraid. The servants unveil the covered chests beside each of us with a coordinated flourish, forcing my attention away. They are each a chest of drawers, familiar in appearance. One could be found in any apothecary. Each of the drawers is labeled with a small plaque.
You will have the length of one incense stick to pick the drink you will make for our champion, Chancellor Zhou says. Using the Dan you harvested from the water lily yesterday to strengthen your connection and your bond to Shennong.
I fish out the ball from my sash, recognizing now its intended purpose. It is a more potent form of the mash I created from ground-up herbs to remove the poison from Ruyi, meant to assist us in achieving the shift. What little I know of it has always been that the process of developing Dan was lost, the methods having been too carefully guarded and relegated to history. It was said to be a magic amplifier, like a voice carried between narrow cliffs until you could be heard from one side of the mountain to the other. Xiao is already confident, heading for his chest of drawers with intention. Wen Yi regards the champions with careful consideration, gaze lingering on Kong with a frown as if he finds him lacking. I take a hesitant step toward the chest,
my hand skimming over the ebony surface. I can almost sense the pulse of the tree from which it was carved. My mother would have loved this cabinet. The wood lacks any strong fragrance that could taint the components inside, and its hardness ensures that the ingredients will not absorb into it over time. There are different varieties of tea leaves in the top drawers, all rare teas, worthy of tribute to the emperor. Two of them speak to me in particular. Heaven's Stream is one that is barely treated, only the youngest buds permitted to be gathered. And Hidden Autumn is an older tea, permitted to grow fully into the fall, then sun-baked until its inner sweetness is released. Opposing properties, depending on how I wish to approach the challenge. I skim over the other additives. Golden flower, jasmine, honeywood, and dried safflower. Huang Qi is also an interesting possibility, its strengthening properties already known to me from previous uses. Lian and I discussed how she had imbued her tonic with strengthening magic, so although it is not my specialty, I know the basics. Kang could do with increased awareness as well, but not so strong as to lose himself in his surroundings, like I personally experienced with the Lion Green. Or perhaps I need to give him something to dull the pain of fighting. But the problem is that my knowledge of fighting styles is woefully lacking because I have never attended a tournament. I can only hazard a guess as to the specifics of the champion's skills. I make my choice of three ingredients. Goji berry for awareness, the bitter yujin to improve circulation and relieve pain, and purple mushroom to increase endurance. A cup of tea worthy of challenging the representatives of the gods. The first round begins as soon as the stick turns to ash, and the chancellor provides the next set of instructions. You will have the length of a spiral incense to prepare and offer your selection, then for your champion to defeat the challenger. Defeat. There will be no ties, no second chances. The challenger must yield. To leave the circle is a failure. To be the first to have blood drawn, failure. So many unknowns. I look down at my ingredients, already questioning my choices. The judges have ranked the remaining competitors by their performances so far. First to begin, Chen Shao of Jia. The chancellor nods at the herald, who lights the spiral incense, and the competition begins. Shao moves forward to brew his cup, and the herbs soak in the water, releasing their aromas. The underlying scent of magic prickles at the back of my throat. Kang accepts the tea with a bow, downs it without hesitation, then steps onto the competition floor. The servants have covered the ground with woven mats. The tortoise moves languidly, sweeping the staff like an extension of his body. Kang moves with speed, dodging his blows. Whenever the staff hits the floor, it's enough to shake the ground beneath us. Eventually, the staff meets the sword with a thunderous crack, and Kang slides back with the force of it, almost falling out of the circle. He rights himself again, and the battle resumes. The wood bends, then snaps back, the sword meeting and returning blows as the opponents clash, separate, and meet again. Kang twists and sidesteps, curving his body like a bow to avoid being crushed by the sweep of the staff. Shao sits on his chair, beads of sweat forming on his brow from the exertion. His lips move silently, communing with the gods, just like when Mother would wrestle with a particularly difficult ailment. I wonder if Kang can hear Shao's voice in his head, whispering. 10 moves later, Kang's sword is at the throat of the tortoise, and the large man bows, conceding defeat. The hall fills with applause. The audience is enraptured, despite their initial hesitation toward their champion. Well done! They call out. Shao wipes his face with a handkerchief, his usual smirk gone. He stands on shaky legs and bows, leaning on the armrest for support. Ling Wen Yi, acolyte of Ye Liu, the herald announces. Chancellor Zhou gestures for Wen Yi to proceed. The tall figure moves with an elegance that speaks to his training. clean, concise movements. No exaggerated efforts to entertain the audience. I'm pulled into his ritual even with my own trial approaching. He uses a stone bowl instead of a cup, with higher sides than a typical one used for eating. Tipping the bowl to one side, hot water is poured down the side and leaps up the curve, creating the illusion of jumping waves. Using his hand to gently rock the bowl, he ensures that the water covers all his ingredients, taking on the golden hue required of a good brew. He places the den under his tongue. Then he hands the bowl to Kung, who accepts it with a nod and tips the tea into his mouth. As he swallows, he grimaces at the taste. It must have been strong. He enters the arena with a black tiger, and with the strike of a match, the next round begins. The tiger moves her feet in sweeping motions, circling back and forth without a clear sense of direction. Kung pulls back, observing her movements, trying to determine where she will place her foot next. There is only the slightest bend in her knees. Then she jumps, easily clearing the space between them. Using her fists, quick as lightning, she beats him back, putting him on the defense. Kung blocks and uses his sheathed sword to sweep her back, but doesn't yet draw it. She regains her balance, then rocks back on her heels, eyes glimmering in the light. A raucous yell erupts from her throat as she leaps again, this time drawing the swords from her back in twin silver arcs. I already noted the unique hilts, which have a guard for the hand that finishes in a sharp point, but the blades are also like nothing I've seen before. The steel is a thin curve, with wicked-looking hooks at the end. Kung uses his scabbard to block the attack, shoving her back with force, then draws his sword in one smooth motion, metal ringing against metal. The attack is on. The tiger crosses her swords and then advances with whirling movements, the swords appearing as if they are spinning in circles. At times, her right hand turns in one direction as her left dips instead of rises, attempting to break his guard. He blocks them all, but her speed puts her at an advantage. His feet slip and falter as he tries to withstand the force of her strikes, but she continues to push him closer and closer to the edge of the circle. It takes me too long to notice there is something wrong with Kung's movements. The tip of his sword seems to move too slowly, and each time he tries to adjust his movements to match the intensity of her attacks, he stumbles slightly. He does not exhibit the strength with which he responded to the tortoise. In fact, he looks to be barely defending himself against the onslaught of the dual blades. With the crescent sweeps of her blades forming two circles, the hooks catch his sword and she pulls. His sword is flung into the crowd of officials and they scatter like fish in a pond. The point of the sword sinks into the ground, the hilt quivering in the air. There is silence in the hall. Kung clutches his shoulder, blood seeping from between his fingers, dripping onto the mat below his feet. He bows to the tiger, acknowledging his defeat. Chapter 40. It appears you have failed the challenge, Chancellor Zhou says to Wen Yi, though his voice is not unkind. But Wen Yi does not address him. Instead, he looks up to the princess and salutes her with his closed fist tucked into an open palm. A salute of deference, accompanied by a deep bow. Although I am not worthy, I ask to address you, Your Highness. There is a roughness to his tone, and from my perspective, I can see his legs trembling. I have never seen him lose his composure in the time we've spent together in the palace. I should have paid more attention to what he was doing, rather than being entranced by Kung's fight against the black tiger. Jin gestures. Speak. I have sullied the competition, princess, Wen Yi says, but without contrition, without apology. Instead of lowering his head in deference, he looks up at her directly instead, as if in challenge. What have you done? The chancellor's words slice through the air. Wenyi drops to one knee in a swift motion, his robe flying behind him. I prepared for your champion a concoction of tea that saps away his strength and disrupts his inner balance. I had hoped the tiger would cut him in half. I could not bring myself to assist this traitor to the Empire. It takes all my effort not to look in Kong's direction. Are you saying you put something in his drink? The princess leans forward, frowning, the worry for her betrothed evident. Their connection must be stronger than I initially believed, forged from childhood. I do not stoop to poison. Wenyi's mouth curls with disdain, and he points a shaking finger at Kong. That is the weapon of his family. His accusation hangs in the air, a storm cloud waiting to devastate the land below. Hatred twists his handsome features into a scowl. Princess Jin settles back in her seat. The matter of who the poisoners are has not been resolved by the Ministry of Justice, she drawls, then turns to the officials who are still watching the scene unfold with uncertainty.